You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. Last week, we began our conversation with Dr. Jonathan Snodgrass of Texas A&M to explore what the grid powers and whether or not it's ready for America's next wave of technological innovation. In part one, Elisa and Dr. Snodgrass broke down the basics of grid infrastructure, its role in national defense, and the warning signs we're already seeing from blackouts abroad. This week, we continue that discussion by turning to what it will take to make the grid more resilient. Elisa and Dr. Snodgrass dive into workforce gaps, critical load planning, and what policymakers often overlook when designing a modern, secure electric grid. As always, thanks for tuning in, and here's Elisa.
What are the backups or redundancies that we have to prevent grid failure? Or really, are there any?
Oh, absolutely. And so this, I love talking about this. So the electric grid has backups on backups and backups. Let's start with nuclear power. Perfect example. So there's redundant everything in nuclear power. If there's a sensor, there's a backup sensor. If there's a cable, there's a backup cable. And so nuclear, if you look at the failures in the US for nuclear power, the failures are zero. Three Mile Island operated as it was intended to. There was a steam valve stuck open and then a sensor caught that and then it shut the plant down. So it's very, very, very safe in terms of an operational perspective. As I mentioned, we have these things called contingency analysis. So let's say you lose one transmission line or two transmission lines. And even now utilities are looking at what we call N minus K. So basically N being the number of transmission lines, K being how many go out, losing a couple dozen. How well can the grid survive losing lots of different parts of the grid and can it keep functioning? The answer is yes. And so what we do is we take the model of the electric grid because, you know, you wouldn't like it if I started experimenting with your power. Oh, now you're out of power because, you know, Dr. Snodgrass is doing experiments on the grid. We make a model, a mathematical and physics-based model, and we say, okay, we run all these simulations to say, okay, what are the most vulnerable components in terms of if this thing went down, would cause the most impact to the grid? And then, okay, well, how can we harden that thing, whatever that thing is, whether it's line, generator, et cetera, transformer, can we harden that? So we look at if a component were to go down, how impactful would it be? And also we look at like probability of failure. So we look at historical outage data saying, oh, this particular transformer has had some issues with failing more, like with tripping out more often. Can we make that particular component more reliable? And can we build another transformer in the nearby such that if this one's out, we can still, you know, operate the grid just fine.
So the question is if we look at it, is anybody looking at it, right?
Absolutely.
So who would be looking at this? Who are the people? Who are the individuals that we're relying on to be looking at those things to make sure that those redundancies are functioning as they're supposed to?
So going back to your very, very first question of like who owns the grid, the fact that there's thousands of entities that are involved with owning and operating grid, that's why it's so beautiful because we have tens of thousands, 100,000 people who are keeping their eyes on this. So everything from like the regulatory side, from FERC and NERC, who have their lawyers and their policy people looking at stuff. They have their own engineers that do studies. And then we have the grid operator level, the East, the West, and Texas. There's, I think, seven primary grid operators. So California, the Northeast, Texas, the Midwest. They have the grid operators that do these studies and do analysis. And then on the lower level, the individual utilities have engineers that also do studies and look at these things. So the fact that it's not like, you know, in China where the grid is owned and operated by one entity, the government, and if they miss something, they're SOL. Whereas here, if say, for example, FERC misses something or NERC misses something on the reliability, the ISOs will often, the independent system operators will oftentimes say, hey, in our studies and our analysis, we noticed this might be an issue. Hey, NERC, you might want to write a standard on this. And then they get together and they write standards. Or like a utility, an ISO might tell the utility, hey, these other utilities over here are encountering this issue, better watch out for it. Because you have so many tens of thousands of engineers and operators, technicians, et cetera, that are working on the grid and communicating, not person to person, but the entities are communicating with each other, you have a lot of checks and double checks and triple checks.
In those double checks and triple checks, I mean, a lot of this stuff has to be running through some sort of computer automation, I would imagine. And I think that in and of itself is generally a vulnerability for any number of reasons, but particularly if it's in any way networked and can be targeted. And even if it's not networked, I mean, somebody could deploy something onto a machine if they were a malicious actor. But I guess the question becomes, Do the checks and the efforts to make sure that redundancies are functioning, did they also involve sort of cybersecurity sweeps, as far as you know?
Oh, absolutely. So backing up a little bit for the bit of the history of the grid. So the grid was around long before, communications were. Telephones were coming of age, and Edison was working on his electricity stuff and Tesla. So cybersecurity, say 80 years ago, was non-existent, right? Neither was communication. Everything was physically done by hand and knobs and switches and dials and physically moving things. Like, the plant operators, there were hundreds of plant operators at these large, say, coal or large nuclear plants because they physically went out and turned, checked dials and moved things around. Problem is, then you have the human in the loop error. There is more communications in it. As the communications increase, so is the cybersecurity. And so NERC-SIP is one of the, there's many, many NERC standards that are involved with making sure things are run properly. So you've got in a utility, you've got the grid operators, and then you've got the cyber operators that are in their little cyber bunker that basically are both watching to make sure that on the grid operator side, make sure the grid's working properly, and the cyber operators are making sure that they're the cyber DevOps people, making sure that they're kind of like the Secret Service people, but for each utility, they're making sure people aren't trying to hack into the grid and looking at all these different types of things. So to answer your question, absolutely yes, both on the physical side and on the cyber side.
So that's the redundancy, but let's talk about sort of the modernity of the grid. I don't think we've really hit on sort of the aging of the grid, because one of the things that I hear talked about, at least popularly and not always by people with an EE background, is that the grid's just not modern. It's not where it needs to be.
So I was one of those people, say 15 years ago, before I became an expert in the field, shall we say. There is some truth, but it's a half truth in the sense that, yes, a lot of the physical hardware, the transformers, the transmission lines, a lot of this stuff was installed decades or, half a century ago. But again, copper, aluminum, steel, a lot of that stuff can last a very, very long time. And with rare exception, there hasn't been a lot of, shall we say, new technology in the let's put some steel poles in the ground and string some wires between them. There was about 50, 60 years where that technology didn't improve. We kind of had mastered the art of stringing aluminum between poles and calling it done. That is changing. Now we have, advanced conductors and things. I sat on a seminar about that. But by and large, why upgrade aluminum to copper? That's an extra expense and only carries a certain amount of current. And that attitude is what the whole, oh, we solved all the problems in power, was what caused a lot of all of the Ivy Leagues and a bunch of the Ivy adjacent schools like Stanford and the UC system to basically say to their power research professors, we can't fire you because you have tenure, but you can't stay here. So they all gutted their power programs. And now they're kicking themselves, all over the place because now there's this huge AI revolution and there's all this electric, electric demand. But if you go and you look at what research has been done in the electrical engineering department, in power, in most of the Ivy League schools, it's crickets because they gutted their power programs 30, 40 years ago. So this whole idea of all the problems had been solved was pretty pervasive. But when you talk about smarts, there's several levels. There's the physical wires of light that go from the poles. For the most part, they're dumb wires, but they don't need to be smart. Why? Because it's a bunch of extra expenses that aren't necessary. Now, there's the protection and control, the metering side of things, the metering, the control, the relays inside of the substation and inside of the control room has massively changed from 30 to 50 years ago. You look at a picture of a control room 50 years ago, like I said, it's a bunch of knobs and dials and, people putting push pins in the wall. And now it's very modernized in the sense of it's digital displays and a person at one console would do what someone in the entire room could do. I mean, you could have one person operating the entire Texas grid if you had to, because there's the opportunity for automation. But just like an airplane can fly without a pilot does not mean that the grid is only operated by one person. There's always people looking and checking and double checking. And have you looked at this thing over here? Oh yeah, that's normal. That's just that. Okay, we're good.
Then let's talk for a second about the scaling issue, because as it exists right now, can it scale? And if it can't, what's needed to make it ready for that?
Right. So here's the big question is how flexible are the data centers willing to be? If they want to come online and just be on all the time and they don't flex with the grid, then it's going to be really challenging. But if they're willing to flex with the grid, like say, for example, the day in Spain, there was a lot of solar and the experts don't know actually what happened yet. All they know is that some nuclear plants tripped off and solar plants tripped off. But that was a day where the load was low and there's a lot of sunshine. But let's say there's a day where it's really hot and it's cloudy. In Texas and California, during the summertime, they're saying, hey, only water once a week for the next month. They tell the data centers, hey, you're for the next week, because it's going to be so hot, the wind is going to be really low, you're going to have to turn down your data center. And if they're willing to do that, then it will scale quite well. The beauty of data centers is that it's not like, oh, an Amazon warehouse. Like if an Amazon warehouse already exists and they're trying to electrify their load, they're not going to move their warehouse. But if the data center people were to go work with their local utility and say, hey, I want to put in a data center, you tell me where the good place is to go. And some utilities would go, oh, we don't want to do that. But some would go, oh, I never thought you'd ask. You know what? You should build right here because you're actually going to create counterflow. Most of the electrons are going to flow from east to west. If you put it here in the east, you're actually creating counterflow on the line that actually ends up helping the grid. Really, data centers need to be a good neighbor. And right now we're not seeing them be good neighbors, but if they wind up being good neighbors, we could hit that 75% load growth.
Well, I mean, right now it seems to me like the big players in data centers, and I welcome correction here. You know, we're looking at I call them the bigs, you know, the Amazons and Microsofts. Mm-hmm. They're exploring nuclear. I mean, they seem to be actively having these conversations on the Hill. And I know that they're looking at a lot of critical minerals, the purpose for which, you know, I think is up for grabs. But the bottom line is, if they decide not to be good players in this space, then there may have to be some legislation and somebody would have to agree to what that looks like. Do you think, I mean, you don't want lawyers or senators drafting this stuff without input from people like you, right? I imagine that, and I'm sort of preaching to the converted here, but I think a lot of what gets drafted doesn't always lean on scientific knowledge.
I had a great meeting with some of my colleagues today and basically saying, we as the engineers and the researchers create a framework saying, hey, we need data centers to operate like this in the sense of this amount of flexibility is required. And then the policymakers can write the laws and the regulations. We can go to NERC and we can go to Congress and say, hey, don't go top down, but bottom up and say, hey, we need the data centers to be able to do this. In this case, the regulatory framework would look like NERC and FERC passing standards or regulation that says, okay, if you're a data center, if the voltage is within this range, you can't drop offline. That's a big issue, is, you know, data center just disappears. It's like the opposite of the solar problem. You know, you had 10 gigawatts of solar that just drops off. But if you have the same thing where you have, you know, a dozen data centers that suddenly there's a voltage drop that's a little lower than normal, but not within the range of grid blacking out. And now you've got a dozen data centers dropping off. You could have an opposite problem happening where you lose gigawatts of load and the frequency shoots up too high. That's an easier problem to deal with because you can't make generation appear out of nowhere, but you can dump power if you like basically put a bunch of toasters on the grid really fast. It's still a hard problem to solve, though. Again, we need the data centers. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So if we engineers say, hey, we need the data centers to operate in this range, and if you're in this range, don't trip offline.
A lot of, I think, humanity has to do with competition for scarce resources.
Bingo.
And so one of the concerns that I think a lot of our listeners have is whether or not these sort of data centers could come to compete with the energy needs of things like the Defense Department. And in that case, as we're, you know, we're living in a time where millionaires, billionaires are increasingly powerful and have greater and greater influence, would they be in a position to, for their own bottom line, you know, siphon off energy that could endanger or disrupt the energy needs of our national security?
Thankfully, no. That's the beautiful part about the critical, non-critical. Data centers, as much as they want to beat their chest and say, oh, we're important, we're critical load, they're not critical load. You know, Pentagon, absolutely critical load. Hospitals, police stations, fire, EMS, emergency management, control centers, those are critical load. You know, if something happened and we call it a load shed, basically. If the load was projected to go higher than generation and we had to shed load, data centers are pretty low on the importance list in terms of like keeping society alive. So the answer to your question is, yeah, thankfully, we do not have to worry about that because of the way that the current regulations are written, both in terms of the utility, the ISO, and, you know, NERC and FERC.
Okay, that's comforting. I'm sure a lot of people will be glad to hear that. Let's talk about sort of the big picture thing here. From an engineering perspective and a funding perspective, what would Congress need to do to better support the grid systems? And let me say, they don't get along and they don't deal with a lot of things, but let's assume that we had a functioning Congress that would actually enact laws in the interest of the United States of America and be less involved in sort of posturing and theater and that kind of thing.
First of all is return to fundamental research. I mean, things are changing so quickly that there's this temptation to kind of get caught up in the buzzwords of AI and this, that, and the other, but we still need to be the world leaders in research and development. So part of the problem was, as a researcher, I noticed that a lot of the calls for proposals in the last administration were pretty politicized. They were a lot of very closely aligned with the priorities of that administration. And when the new administration came in, they saw that and decided to cut it all. We need to go back to nonpartisan research, grid reliability, clean, affordable energy for all Americans. That should not be a political issue. So we need to have research R&D funding that outlives administrations, that isn't one party pushing their pet projects and then the next party cutting the funding. That's, I think, one of the issues. Two, Congress needs to make it easier for utilities to do interregional transmission planning. So if you have renewables that are farther from the load centers, oftentimes there need to be transmission lines built across several utilities. And it's very difficult to do that for a bunch of reasons. And there's been a lot of talk about interregional transmission, but a lot of it, again, is talk. Talk is cheap and actions are hard. That and the production tax credits need to be revisited for renewables because they were very exclusive of other carbon-free generation. So it was specifically looking at wind or specifically looking at solar, but nuclear is carbon-free and dispatchable. So the nuclear kind of got left off the table for 10 or 15 years, and now we're really paying the price. So I think we need to stop biasing and pushing for one type of generation. Instead, we need something that is dispatchable, carbon-free, this, and meets these requirements. And you tell the engineers, you go figure, rather than being like wind and solar. Instead saying, okay, I want to be more agnostic. Okay, that could be solar plus batteries. It could be wind plus batteries. It could be nuclear. It could be natural gas with carbon sequestration. It could be natural gas plus carbon capture. It could be some new technology that we've never made. But the problem is when you specifically subsidize a certain industry, it stifles competition across all the other industries. Because now, instead of looking to make the next generation of clean electricity, we're just dumping more and more money into solar or wind.
So I guess one of the questions that I have is, we are talking about renewable energy, which is attractive because the planet's warming. And a lot of the blame obviously has been placed on fossil fuels. With respect to the grid, as the climate is changing and it's warming kind of faster, I think, is the grid going to be able to manage that? Are we building in things to the grid to recognize the fact that the climate is changing? Are there things that we need? Is there stuff Congress should be doing? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so Texas is the perfect example in that the grid here is designed to operate in very hot conditions. There are power plants that had operating temperature 32 degrees or 0 degrees Celsius and above. We didn't get that contract because we very wisely said, no, that's ridiculous. You need freeze protection. And if they built it according to spec, I can guarantee you that was one of the plants that froze in 2021. But on the flip side, say the UK, their grid is not designed to operate in extreme heat. Can it? Yes, but it's going to be derated. Your power plants, steam-based ones, are going to be less efficient in hotter temperatures if they're not designed to handle that. Most of the grid equipment can handle heat better than it can cold, because when stuff freezes, it doesn't typically do so well. But if it's 40 degrees compared to 43 or 42 degrees Celsius, that's less of an issue. It's less of a concern in terms of the operation and control of the grid.
Okay, so do we have enough people with your expertise to plan, operate, and optimize the grid? Because you just mentioned, you know, some of these, you talked about Ivies adjacents, having gutted some of these departments. I mean, that is concerning. Do we have that workforce? Is that going to be a workforce issue in the future?
I would say it's probably less of an issue. There are plenty of universities that resisted that urge to cut their power programs. So Texas A&M, Georgia Tech, Arizona State, University of Wisconsin-Madison, a bunch of others, Virginia Tech. While other schools were cutting their programs, they were scaling up their power programs. And so now we, you know, have tons of power engineers that are coming out of A&M. Part of the struggle is a pay issue. So for example, there's a lot of people going into work for utilities. The problem is utility work is a little boring. Banking and electric utilities are both very resistant to change, which makes sense. The CrowdStrike issue that happened when that shut down, you know, airports across the nation and other infrastructure, when someone said, oops, you know, imagine that if that happened on the grid. You don't say oops on the grid. So you're very, very slow and reluctant to change. But because of that, you know, you don't think of utilities as being, you know, the most cutting edge, new, exciting technologies happening. There is some innovation in utilities, and that's definitely happening more today. But the stability of the job is good, the benefits are good, but the pay isn't the greatest. And so you have people that will work for utility who are electrical engineers that then get poached by OpenAI or Microsoft or Google and get offered twice to three times the salary. It's less of a workforce going in. It's more of the work drain. It's more people getting sucked out of the power area into much more lucrative jobs that are much flashier, but they wind up making a lot more money. That, I think, is more of the struggle.
You said you grew up in California, somewhere outside the Mojave Desert. I mean, I'm trying to picture that and how it is, like, a guy who grew up in that area would have become interested in electrical engineering in the first place. I mean, were you just a hobbyist? How did you get there?
Yeah, great question. My parents moved to Texas when I was two. I didn't quite actually grow up there. It's a bit of a slip of the tongue. I was born there and moved to Texas when I was about 2.5. I always loved math and science, and I thought I wanted to be a physicist, but then I realized I like more of applied. So when I went to university, I got interested in computers. Computer engineering was the huge thing, and it still is now, you know, AI. But then I realized I actually hate coding. I hate writing computer code. And so I tried to find a class that was as far away from it. And I was like, electric power, that's like the most regressive non-computer coding, which is actually false. I spent 5 years in my graduate program doing nothing but coding in MATLAB. So haha. But what I realized is that the electric grid is the biggest circuit in the world. Deep in the heart of every engineer is the desire to make the world a better place.
What would you do to improve the current grid and, let's say, the near future grid in the interest of national security if you had a magic wand?
Get politics out of research. If I had a magic wand, I would just go sproing and I would get politics out of research. I mean, okay, perfect example is electric vehicles should not be politicized. They're great. They have pros, they have cons. You have on one side, you have people saying they're going to save the world and other people saying they're, you know, they're awful. They're not going to save the world. They're one piece of the puzzle that will save the world, but they're not awful. And it's like, stop politicizing electric vehicles, stop politicizing nuclear, stop politicizing renewables on the pro and the con side. Don't push renewables, but don't go against renewables. Say, we need carbon-free generation. We need clean generation. And then let the industry figure out what that looks like.
Sounds like a pretty good answer. I do think there's something in us organically. It's something that's been written on our DNA that forces us into tribes. And I think for some reason, politics has, I mean, we need tribes for whatever reason. And I think that politics has become a substitute for tribe. But anyway, it's been really fun to talk to you. And I'm really glad that we got a chance to do that. You're obviously excited and you know a lot about this stuff. And I wish you really good luck on all your research. I hope it goes
Thank you.
Our guest tonight has been Dr. Jonathan Snodgrass of Texas A&M University. We're going to link his amazing bio in the notes to the cast. And thank you for listening to NSLT, and be sure to subscribe on your listening app of choice. If you like our long form podcast, be sure to give us a like and rate us too. Take some time to share this episode with a friend and have a civil conversation about the issues we raise, because they're going to be important to the country and our national security. We encourage you to hear other people's points of view. We're not great at that right now in this country, but you know that if you're a lawyer or a law student, that's going to help you up your game. And that's the truth, because if you don't hear an argument, you can't really respond to it effectively. And remember, a key feature of our national security in our country, which is our unity, despite the fact that we have greater diversity of thought than probably any other country in the world. So thank you, and we will look forward to seeing you next time. Our writer and producer and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. NSLT's co-producer and editor is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is the amazing Holly McMahon, and all the brilliant and thoughtful leaders of the nonpartisan Standing Committee of Law on Law and National Security. And before I go, I want to thank Antasia Hawkins, who helped me tonight, who is just another wonderful addition from Scotland's. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.